On today's episode of The Good Word, Howard Beck joins us to talk about the inevitability of Nikola Jokic, Zion looking like Zion again, how will the Spurs build around Big Slim, and we tell you which NBA teams we're just a little bit worried about. All that and much more on today's episode of The Good Word.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. If you're part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast, get us wherever you get your podcast. We are also on YouTube, where you will see the face of the man in the green t-shirt. And I'm not allowed to say it because I didn't create the phrase. Kobe Bryant created the phrase, but I'm going to say it anyway. What up, Beck? Howard Beck from The Ringer. He was actually my second guest of this podcast last year on March 27th. So if I had just waited a week, you know, we could have just did a Beck anniversary. But Howard Beck, how you doing, man?
What up, Vinny? Thank you for the kind introduction. I have to ask, since I was, in fact, the second guest ever on this pod, and what I remember about that most is that I had the pressure of following the great Bomani Jones because he was your first guest. And I thought, well, that's just setting me up to fail. I didn't check who was on just before me this time. Who am I having to try to? Who's rep am I having to replicate?
Last week we had the creator of the unofficial "We're Done with the '90s," Nick Wright.
That's fine. I can follow Nick Wright. Following Bomani is like that's an unfair standard. Nick's all right. Nick's okay.
Look, Nick is a New Yorker, just like you, although Nick is a little on the other side of the borough, because you're in Brooklyn. You're a hipster Brooklynite.
And Nick in Manhattan? I don't even know.
Hmm?
Nick, is he a Manhattan guy?
Oh, yep, yeah. Nick figures. Is Manhattan.
That figures. Yeah. You know, TV guys, they got the big bucks. They can live in Manhattan.
There you go. Now, before we begin, and this wasn't on the rundown, but I just thought of it because I'm very frustrated with the NBA and some of their new criteria for all NBA. If you are a voter, if you are voted for all NBA, MVP, all that, not the 65 game criteria, not even talking about that. Howard Beck, how do you feel about the NBA going positionless on the all NBA and all defensive ballot? Because I hate it.
Yeah, it's funny. I think we've all spent more time justifiably talking about the 65 game rule because week by week, it is just knocking dudes out. And on the one hand, it's taking some of the judgment out of our hands as the voters. On the other hand, it's kind of making our lives a little bit easier because the list of potential candidates gets shorter. It will actually make for less stress in the end, even if I'm not sure I agree with it. The positionless thing, it's interesting. All right, so my boss, Bill Simmons at The Ringer, Bill has said on his pod multiple times, including, I think, this week, he's still going two guards, two forwards, and a center. First, second, third team. And he's the only one I know who has been a voter for years who has said definitively that he doesn't care that the NBA has taken the positions off the ballot. He's just still going to go the traditional way. I'll be curious how many other voters decide to do that, Vinny. I'll be curious to see whether I decide to do that, assuming I have a ballot again this year, because I don't know. My leaning is to still go with positions. Mm-hmm. So quick framework here. For years, people have talked about all NBA and they go, well, you know, this guy's a top 15 player in the NBA. No, he's not. All NBA is not literally 1 through 15. All NBA is the top 6 guards and the top 6 forwards and the top 3 centers. That's it. It is not literally the top 15.
Right.
And in any given season, we had obviously years and years where center was just a wasteland. And, you know, guys who ordinarily, like, you know, DeAndre Jordan made an All-NBA team or two, right? Like, yes. He was never a top 15 player.
I think he was
player.
First team in 2014.
Yeah, right. So, but on DeAndre Jordan, all due respect, I loved DeAndre Jordan in his prime, but, like, he was not a top 15 player in the NBA. He was a top 3 center during a time when there weren't a lot of centers doing a lot of stuff. So, I think every position is pretty strong right now. So, there's no concern for me if I have to go 3 centers. The problem is, what if you thought there were 4 centers who were, let's say Embiid were still healthy. And it's Embiid and Jokic and Gobert and, you know, Bam or whomever it might be. And are you, is it justifiable to have a fifth or a fourth center knocking out a forward or a guard? We have a wealth of great guards in this league. Are you, if you're going to over index on guards, you're going to disadvantage some other positions. I'm not sure, Vinny, that I actually care to have the top 15, 1 through 15. I never did care. I liked the fact that the All-NBA teams simulated what an NBA starting five looked like. And yeah, some years that meant you had to shoehorn in guys who...
Them's the breaks, man.
Yeah, that was the breaks. It happens. So I was fine with that. And by the way, positionless is such an overused term. The NBA is not positionless. It is positionally fluid. You have, you know, guys who will play anywhere from 3 through 5. You have centers who play more like guards, like Jokic. You have centers who just, you know, have an outside shot, so they're more like the old school kind of power forward or even small forward. You have really tall dudes like Kevin Durant with guard skills, or Giannis, or, you know, you've Luka, who's built more like a small forward or even a power forward, depending on the era, but he's a point guard.
Right.
But not everybody. You can't literally just throw any five dudes out there without respect to height or skill set. We just have a lot of positional fluidity and skill set fluidity that goes across all five players, but it's not positionless. It really isn't. So I'm not entirely comfortable with voting that way. And I don't know how I'll ultimately do it when we get ballots in a few weeks. You?
I am leaning towards doing what the All-Star, what we do for the All-Star balloting. 2 backcourt, 3 frontcourt. And I think that, I won't even say that's splitting the baby. I just think that is, if you're talking about what a lead guard is as opposed to a point guard, and you're talking about what, you know, the swing positions are, like I said in the last podcast when it was just me and John, you have functions. You have guys who protect the rim. You have guys who are shooters. You have guys who initiate the offense. That's how it goes. It's not necessarily, oh, the point. Look, Rudy Gobert is in Minnesota right now, because Karl Towns doesn't function as a defensive center because they need someone to protect the rim. Like, that's just how it goes. Rant over, frustrated with the league. The league's always trying to appease, like, some sect that they'll either never gain, or some sect that's just loud and for whatever reason. Like, I don't get it. If I ever have Adam Silver on here, I will ask the commissioner about it. I tell you this, this would never happen in David Stern's NBA. This would never have happened in the Emperor's NBA. I miss David Stern. Okay, I'll just rant over. Now, All right. Now, last night, Nuggets and Timberwolves in this weird scheduling quirk where it feels like divisional opponents play each other a lot towards the end of the regular season. I'm guessing it's to cut down on travel at the end of the regular season to sort of save some air miles. Nuggets beat the Timberwolves. It was a really entertaining, a really, really fun game. Even though the T-Wolves were without Karl Towns, without Rudy Gobert, without Naz Reid, they hung in there, and I thought for a minute that they were just going to ride the emotion and ride that wave and beat the champs. But the champs just did what they do. Like, Michael Porter Jr. found something in the fourth quarter. Jokic hit 35 and 16. And it looks to me, Howard, that Jokic is about to join this 3-MVP club. That I count MVPs, at least modern MVPs, from the time that the media started voting, which was in 1980. Like, when the players voted, it was a little wonky. It was a little weird. Like, you had years where, you know, Bill Russell won MVP, but was all NBA second team behind Will. Like, it was just weird. But for all intents and purposes, here's the list of 3 MVP players: Russell, Wilt, Kareem, Moses, Bird, Magic, LeBron, Mike. It feels like Jokic belongs in that category, assuming that he wins. Whether he wins or not is immaterial. I feel like he belongs in that room. The resume that he's putting together, and I'm penciling Denver into June. I don't know who they're going to be there against, but I'm penciling in the Denver Nuggets there. I feel like they're at the peak of their powers, you know, the champion, heart of a champion, all that type of stuff. The resume that he's putting up, what fascinates that about you? You know what I mean, to you?
So it's interesting because we do, these unofficial clubs, right? The 3 MVP club or the 3 in a row MVP club, which people seemed reticent about Jokic joining when he was up for possibly a third straight last year. And I try, you know, there's 2 ways of looking at this. There's you and I having this discussion on a podcast where we just talk about like the scope of the NBA and NBA history and like how do we place guys and all that. We could talk about, you know, the top 10 of all time, top 20. Where do guys fit into all this? And then there's like the fundamentals of just like balloting. Like I always focus on the season itself. I don't care if this means we're now elevating a guy to some other. You can't look at it that way. Does Jokic deserve to have three and be in the club that you just threw out there? I don't care about that in the moment that I'm voting. The right. ballot is the ballot. The field is the field. Jokic is the clear leader right now. I don't know if anything's going to change that in the next few weeks, but we'll see. The idea of Jokic being in that club, so separate discussion, right? Ballot discussion's over here. Historical discussion. I mean, he is one of the, like, most unique. Every frickin' grammar teacher I've ever had will just like smash me over the head, and every frickin' copy editor will beat me over the head. There is no such thing as most unique. You're just either unique or you're not, or what? Sorry, everybody. I apologize. He's one of the most unique players we've ever seen. and everybody in that category in some way was so distinctive that we think of them as a one of one, right? And there might have been, you know, like we had some Michael Jordan clones or Michael Jordan wannabes or guys who patterned themselves after him. We've had since Wilt, there have been a bunch of other dominant centers, but nobody quite like him. So there are reasonable facsimiles of, but most guys who are in that level, that tier of legend are one of one. Jokic is one of one. He really is. And he is like the fully realized version of what people have been referring to as positionless basketball, a center who plays like a point guard. And like, if he ends up with this third MVP, I mean, he's going to end up with one regardless. Like, maybe it's this balloting cycle. Maybe it's next year or the year after. Eventually, he's going to have a third and maybe more. And I don't think we should be worried about, you know, what club that places him in. Like, he's got at least one title. We'll see if he's going to tack on more. Again, I think that's a separate discussion. You don't necessarily need multiple titles to justify your multiple regular season MVPs. These are separate things. The dude's legitimately great in a way, and he's great in a way that we've never seen anybody else be great before.
Right, right.
I'm fine with it.
No, I have zero problem with it. I think what goes a little understated about this Howard is he's probably one of the greatest player development stories we've ever seen in NBA history.
Second round pick? Yeah.
Not just from where he was drafted, but from how he played. Like, he was clearly undervalued in terms of scouting and everything else, but just from where he came from as a rookie and developing and hitting these different markers. And big men often take a longer time to reach their full potential compared to everybody else. Like Shaq, I don't think won MVP until year 8, maybe, in LA. And I think you covered Shaq in that 2000 season. And Shaq had been through different iterations of himself, but became a full-grown, devastating, both ends of the floor monster that first year with Phil Jackson. And I say that to say, man, this dude is so freaking good. Like there is a difference between, like, you put Oklahoma City there, the Timberwolves are there. Those three teams are battling for top seed in the Western Conference. And not just top seed. They're battling to see who's going to face the winners of those play-ins, which you can look at it and say, all right, maybe they want to play the Lakers. Maybe they don't want to play the Golden State. Maybe they don't want to play Phoenix or Sacramento, whomever. I don't think Denver gives a damn, because Denver at this point is so inevitable. Like, they know what, you can close your eyes and you know what sets they're going to run in the last 5 minutes of the game. Pick and roll with Murray. You put Jokic somewhere around the top of the key to the free throw line, and you just wait on the double. If they come with a double, here comes Aaron Gordon sliding down to the dunker, or there goes KCP or Reggie Jackson, whomever else is on the floor, and he's going to look left and pass right. Like, there is literally an inevitable feeling about him that almost makes you feel helpless. And I don't think this league has felt helpless against a particular player probably since Jordan. Not even really, and maybe Shaq in a different way, but you had to worry about if Shaq was completely in shape and Shaq was completely motivated. And even with LeBron, because LeBron could have some, he could have some brain farts, even at the most critical elements of a certain game and at the peak of his powers. Like, when he won 4 out of 5 MVPs, I think did he squeeze one title out of there? I think two titles, because he had those two titles on the back end of Miami. But even then, there were questions about the Heat as a team. Could they get it done? I feel like we're fooling ourselves, Howard, if we think any team can truly challenge the Nuggets. What I feel like what everybody else is asking is, who's matching up with the Nuggets so, you know, y'all take them out? Like, we don't want to deal with them. Y'all take them out, and then maybe our path to the finals will be easier. Nobody's looking around and saying, we'll volunteer to take on the Denver Nuggets. We'll be the ones to take out the Kings. I don't see that at all.
Yeah. It's funny because we talk about how many, like, plausible contenders there are, like teams that we say, like, oh, the Clippers, yeah, at their best. Yeah, I could see them going to the finals. I could see them potentially winning a championship. And then you go like, oh, Thunder and Wolves. Well, they're really young, but they're really talented. And yeah, they've got the goods. They could make, but in every case, it's to your point. It's like, who's knocking out Denver first? Because somebody, once, if Denver's out, then it's like, oh, I can see, like, there's a path for the Warriors. There's a path for the Lakers. There's a path for the Suns. But some, you're right. Like, it still comes down to like, okay, if, like, because I've done this exercise before the season. If you had asked me Nuggets or the Field, I'd say the Field. And that wasn't a slight at the Nuggets. It's just a recognition of two things. One, it's really freaking hard to repeat in this league, and it doesn't happen very often. And the teams, and this goes to point two, the teams that do repeat, Vinny, are usually teams that are just stacked, right?
Yeah.
It's LeBron and Wade and Bosch. It's Steph and Durant and Clay and Draymond. It's Shaq and Kobe. It's Michael and Scotty. And Denver fans, some of them get offended at this, but I'm sorry. Like, it's Jokic and an ensemble. And I know Jamal Murray's constantly bumping up against all NBA and all-star and everything, and he's always hurt at the wrong times. And it's not that he's not talented enough to be in those conversations, but like, he's not that guy at this stage. They don't have a true second star in the same way that most, especially repeat champions, have.
Right.
That's not a knock. And by the way, it is reflective of the era that we're in, right? Giannis in an ensemble, Kawhi in an ensemble in Toronto. We've had a lot of ensembles. Even the last Warriors championship
was Steph in an ensemble.
Right. These are not super teams. So because the Nuggets don't profile as the consummate, dominant, multi-year NBA powerhouse, I do look at them as, like, vulnerable is like too strong of a word, but there's a little bit more vulnerability than if you had, you know, another top 10 player next to Jokic. They don't. That's not a knock. What they do at such a high level that I don't know if anybody could actually beat them, but there's a little bit more margin for error for the opposing team, because if you can somehow slow up Jokic, good luck. A couple of times in a series, you know, like, he so much relies on his playmaking and scoring and his everything,
right,
that I think there's a little bit more of an opportunity there for opponents. But still, there, you mentioned the last few minutes of a game. They're not shooting themselves in the foot. They're not making mistakes, you know, so you have to be perfect down the stretch of a game. And that's kind of what we saw in that game last night. And granted, you know, Minnesota was shorthanded, but still, like, if it's close, the edge goes to Denver every time, because they're just going to do everything right in the last 3-4 minutes of a game.
There's something demoralizing, and we're going to move on, but there's something demoralizing about playing a team that you know will not beat itself. That if they're going to be beat, you have to be the one to do it, as opposed to you forcing them into errors or you forcing them into playing uncharacteristically. And I don't even know, to be perfectly honest, Howard, I'm not sure how a second superstar would be fully actualized playing next to Jokic, because for as unselfish as he is, he does need the entire palette. He does need the freedom to play the way that he plays, which is spraying a bunch of, you know, role players around him who can do very specific things. You know, I don't know how that plays with someone who needs, you know, a 25 usage or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a very weird thing. But moving on, Howard, because there's another team in the West I'm really fascinated with that we do not talk about because we have trust issues. We do. We have trust issues with the New Orleans Pelicans. And I don't know if that's, Howard, because of what we saw in the in-season tournament, or if that's because of what we historically seen or not seen from Zion Williamson. But you look up, and I know they beat Brooklyn last night. Brooklyn's a tomato can. They're going through what they're going through. But New Orleans is firmly in that 4-5 spot. 8-2 in their last 10. Second best net rating in March behind Boston. And they're literally breathing down the neck of the LA Clippers. And Zion post break, he's been amazing. And people have said he's down his weight. He's lost weight, all that. I don't know if he's lost weight or not. He used to look like a refrigerator. Maybe now he looks like a Frigidaire. You know what I mean? He's lost a little bit of weight. And he's like a, say lean, but that dude is flying through the air. Like you, Howard, were you at the game last night?
Typical of me, I was there for half of the game. I left at halftime to come home because I wanted to watch Denver and Minnesota. Next thing I know, I'm looking down at my phone from my couch going, oh, shit, I just missed one of the dunks of the entire season.
But so what do we do with New Orleans? Because the last time New Orleans was actually in focus, it was that embarrassing play in the in-season tournament in Vegas, and all the criticism for Zion came then. And usually what happens is we criticize you, and we forget about you until you make us come back. Zion is making us come back. Where do they fit? And not in necessarily a championship discussion, because I don't think that's their goal or anything like that. But I feel like we spent so much time with Clippers and Suns and Lakers and Warriors that this team is sitting right there with youth, with length, with relative experience. They're not going to be a party crasher, in my opinion, Howard. I think they're going to be really a factor in the playoffs.
They definitely are. Look, the bar of the NBA, generally speaking, for title contention, who actually has a legitimate claim to be a quote-unquote contender? The cutoff is 50 wins. It's always been 50 wins pretty much, right? Unofficially. But, you know, go back through NBA history, find me a team, in especially in the modern NBA, like in the 2000s or even the 90s going forward, find a team that won a championship that did not win at least 50 games in a full 82-game season. So you got to adjust. If you're looking at the all-time standings, folks, you'll have to adjust for a couple of lockouts and a couple of COVID-shortened seasons. You got to be a 50-win team. You know how many 50-win or many teams are on a 50-win pace right now? It's 8, which is a pretty healthy number. In the East, Boston, Milwaukee, Cleveland. That's the cutoff. New York is knocking on the door. But Boston, Milwaukee, Cleveland are all on at least a 50-win pace. In the West, it's Oklahoma, Denver, Minnesota, the Clippers, and the Pelicans. Your New Orleans Pelicans, Vinny Goodwill. So there you go. That's the list. If we're talking about historical standards for what profiles as a contender, the Pelicans are in that conversation. The Suns, the Warriors, the Lakers, the Mavericks are not. Now, we're also living in strange times and soaring parity and... who knows? You know, the Heat went to the finals as a play-in team. So
right.
Everything seems like it's on the table. But we should be talking about the Pelicans as a legitimate contender. We should be talking about them as a legitimate contender with more serious tones than we talk about the Warriors and Lakers, with all due respect to Steph and LeBron. The Pelicans, offensively, defensively, talent, depth, all of it. Like, why? Like, the only thing that's holding us back is, as you said, trust issues. Hashtag trust issues.
There's this thing, like, we like our portly gentlemen in college. We don't necessarily like our portly gentlemen in the NBA. We kind of make them objects of
Oliver
ridicule
Miller?
And jokes. Yeah, that's true. But Oliver Miller wasn't a star, so he could be the lovable, jolly fellow. You know what I mean? A little different. But when Zion Williamson decides, I'm taking Kawhi Leonard, I'm taking that matchup, baby, that says to me a competitive fire. And also that just says, hey, Herb Jones, go be the roamer. Go do something else. That unlocks a different level of things that New Orleans can do. And if they're getting healthy and they're going to stay healthy, and health is going to be such an important part of all of these playoffs, especially considering the team I'm going to talk about next, I might have to spend some time in New Orleans over the next couple of months. So I don't know how long we're going to be there. Just saying, I may have to spend a little bit of time there, Howard, because maybe they're going to knock out one of these teams that we think is going to put it together because they have name recognition and they got old dudes. And I'm learning more and more. I'll say learning. I've always known this. More and more, this is becoming a younger man's game. And these young dudes are going to put these old dudes out to pasture. Now, Howard, you live in New York City. You used to cover the New York Knicks for the New York Times, which means that you have PTSD from that experience. I hope you sought therapy and
it's ongoing.
You've cleansed, right. You've cleansed out your system. OG Anunoby, who underwent a procedure on his right elbow, came back, looked good, but now he's back out again, out indefinitely. He changes the math for them. He makes things so much easier for Jalen Brunson. We haven't really seen this New York team fully healthy, and who knows if we ever will. How do you see that whole thing playing out? Not just with him, but with the Knicks, because I don't know how good they can be. Maybe they can get out of the first round, depending on what the matchup is. But if OG Anunoby is not 80, 90% of himself, I don't know how far this thing goes.
Yeah, I mean, he's really important. Like, all the stats, I don't have them at my fingertips, but people have documented this to the nth degree. Like, the impact that Anunoby has made on the Knicks since they got him in late December, however you want to slice it, their record when he plays, their offensive rating, their defensive rating, their net rating, their everything. Like, he just makes an impact on everything, and he allows everybody else to be their best in their respective positions. And yes, you know that every night you go out there, he's going to go erase somebody. Somebody on the other team, most likely, you know, a perimeter type, is going to have a very rough time scoring because OG Anunoby is going to blanket them. It's a huge advantage to have. It's a wonderful asset to have. And yeah, we're sitting here in, you know, whatever. Is March 20th now late March, or are we still mid-March?
Once you reach the 20th.
I think that's late March.
Late.
We're using toward late March. Yeah, like, this is a bad time for one of your best players to be kind of like having a recurrence of something.
And don't say anything about Tibbs teams having injuries, because Frank Isola will come down and strike you.
Okay. He will do an entire hour segment on NBA radio. But fortunately, it's at the hour that I'm still asleep. So, no, I mean, like, and clearly Anunoby, how soon after he got to New York that this became a thing. Clearly, it was something that he had when at the time of the trade. Like, there was something already going on, I think.
Right.
Still, absolutely the right move, obviously, to get him. Like, the Knicks are super good, right? The question I have for the Knicks, even if Anunoby is playing, is the same question I just have for everybody, which is, like, is anybody really good enough to knock out the Celtics? And the question for the Knicks on top of that is, as great as Brunson has been, and holy crap, what a revelation he has been. And it even just, like, revelation suggests that like maybe there was something hidden, and to an extent that's the case, but it's also just the advances he has made since becoming the guy in New York, as opposed to a sidekick in Dallas. We still, and I know it's reductive and it's annoying and all this, but like in the NBA, generally, it's like, who's got the best player on the floor in a playoff series? And you're probably still going Tatum over Brunson and Giannis over Brunson. And if Embiid were healthy, it's Embiid over Brunson. And so I that's not a knock on Jalen Brunson, but, but you do wonder in this league that is so, so talent driven. Everything is so much determined at the highest level. Who makes the conference finals, the finals, wins the championship, by who's got the biggest, baddest dude on the floor. Not always biggest, but definitely the baddest. And Brunson's great. And when Julius Randle's healthy, and when he's on his the best version of himself, Julius Randle's really good. By the way, that's the other big X factor here right now. They're still winning a lot of games without Randle. When Randle comes back, assuming he comes back and is any semblance of himself in the playoffs, it's a net gain because you need his talent and you need another outlet. You need there to be less pressure on Jalen Brunson to carry the entire scoring load. But Randle at his worst sometimes gets a little ball dominant and a little bit the ball sticks and it disrupts everything else. The ball right now is moving so well for them. They're such a selfless team. And they play a beautiful brand of basketball. Will it continue as fluidly when Randle gets back? I know he's been better this season about a lot of this stuff. But that's the question. They've got like two major pieces with Randle and Anunoby. When are they back? What do they look like when they're back? How healthy are they? How great is their rhythm? Because I think the Knicks have to be like better as a collective to overcome the fact that like the Celtics, who eventually everybody's measuring against the Celtics in the East, They've got the best starting five. They've got the best six. What's that?
I have lots of questions about the Celtics, but go ahead.
There's always questions, but talent-wise, yes. Do they have the best starting five in the East? Do they have the best for one through six in the East? I think it's pretty clear they do. You have to find a way to overcome that.
Yes, and the thing with Randle, like you said, best version of yourself and not upsetting the apple cart because the ball can stick with him. And with Jalen Brunson, look, it's a very short list, a very, very short list of players, not who's led their teams to championships at that height, who even just led their teams to the finals. In modern NBA, and I consider modern NBA 1984, 16 teams in the playoffs, four playoff rounds, at least five games in the first round. They went to seven in 2002.
Mistake. They should have stayed at five.
2003. They should have. 2003. They should have, especially with the play-in. Especially with the play-in, Howard. Yeah. We can go to best of five in the first round, really tighten the screws on some of these teams. You can't – I was about to curse. But you can't really be messing around in the first round with a five-game series. Like, you get Steph in a short series or you get LeBron in a short series. Now we're really cooking with something. Yeah. But there's three players that's in that six-feet range. Three dudes who have carried their teams to the NBA Finals at that height. Stephen Curry, Isaiah Thomas, Allen Iverson. All completely special, different types of special, but special type of ball players. And Jalen Brunson, I think, is really, really good. I'm not sure if he's in necessarily that class, and I don't know if the Knicks are that good to get through a diminished Eastern Conference. I don't even know if they're good enough to get through the diminished Eastern Conference because they themselves are diminished. But when we come back with Howard Beck, I'm going to ask Howard about the favorite Rookie of the Year candidate, or at least my favorite Rookie of the Year candidate, after we pay some bills. Of course, we're talking about Big Slim. Right back here with Howard Beck from The Ringer on the Good Word with Goodwill podcast. Howard, we're not going to be able to talk about Big Slim for much longer after the next month because the Spurs stink. And maybe they stink by design, right? I'm not sure. But Big Vic, I feel like he's wrapped up the Rookie of the Year award. I don't know if it's unanimous. I don't know if it's close, whatever it's going to be. But be that as it may, the man is averaging nearly four blocks a game out of the All-Star break. Like, he should be in the defensive, all-defense conversation, but he probably won't be because the Spurs are so bad, and how effective are you defensively if your team stinks? I totally get that. I'm just saying, watch the dude every night. And when I look at Howard, the way that they're set up, they're going to have probably another top five pick, and they are going to have cap space. But the question is, A, do we trust that Greg Popovich knows how to put a team together in today's NBA when you look at the Devin Vassells and Keldon Johnsons and Jeremy Sohans and how they all kind of don't seem to fit next to this dude?
Oh, man. It's a really interesting conversation with the Spurs, right? Because they have decades under Pop and R.C. Buford. And, you know, R.C.'s not in that basketball role anymore. He's more of this kind of overseeing business role and whatever else. Brian Wright's the GM, and like, Pop is still team president. But the Pop and R.C. Buford partnership that has consistently found talent late in the draft, international talent, undervalued talent on other guys' rosters, I still default to, I trust the Spurs to figure this out. And I know there's a lot more doubts floating around about that the last few years than in the past. And there's even now people, like, you know, a lot more doubts now about, like, has Pop lost touch with even just how to coach? I think that particular line is maybe being a little overstated. But the Spurs didn't have a North Star for the last several years, right? Mm-hmm, and they were not assured, all conspiracy theories aside, they were not assured of getting Wemby, for that matter. So it's not like they could have prepared for, we're going to have Wemby, so we got to start building the infrastructure. No, they just like, all right, well, Keldon Johnson, Devin Vassell, whoever. We're just getting dudes who we think have some upside, or who we can develop, or who we're going to run with for a little bit until we figure out what our foundation is. Well, now it's clear. Like, you have your North Star. You have your foundation. You have Victor Wembanyama. So now is the moment when you can actually sit here and say, what do we need around him and how do we get it? Can we get it? So I think the judgments are a little harsh and a little premature toward the Spurs, in that this is the first moment they've had in years where you could say, now we know what we're about. And if we're going to judge them, let's judge them after this offseason, right? Let's see what they do in the draft. Let's see what they do in July. Let's see what they do in free agency and trades. But I will say, like, there is a considerable amount of pressure on them because of the times we live in, right? There was always pressure on teams who, if you get the top pick, and if the top pick absolutely happens to be a LeBron James caliber player, or, you know, a Shaquille O'Neal caliber player, the pressure's there immediately to build around them and to get it right quickly. But I feel like more so now, just because of the way the league is these days, and the just 24/7 chatter from folks like us and fans and everybody else. The question is, like, how much do they actually need? Like, if they just got one stud co-star, whoever that may be, does everybody else fall into place in their roles because now you don't need quite as much Devin Vassell or as much Keldon Johnson or whoever, or Jeremy Sohan? Do they need more than that? Like, how big is the lift this summer? And I haven't drilled that deep on it, and I'm not sure. Right, and as you and I both know, sometimes one player makes all the difference in the world, right?
Yes. I think, I don't necessarily group all three of those guys together. Like, we just tend to look at Sohan and Keldon Johnson and Devin Vassell like all one and the same. They're not. They function completely different. Vassell is the guy that they have signed long-term and for big money. So clearly they believe in him individually. I think his extension kicks in next year. So they got him signing for the next 5 years. But any contract can be traded. Keldon Johnson, he's got, I think, 2 more years after this one, 3 more years after this one, 19, 17, and 17. And Sohan is on a smaller deal. The Trae Young stuff is really going to be fascinating this summer because of where the Hawks are, where Trae Young is. And, you know, you've heard through the grapevine, I'm sure you've heard, like I've heard, you know, the Trae Young to San Antonio rumors. I'm not sure if that's the guy, because we just look at the Spurs and say they need someone to get him the ball, and these dudes don't get him. I've never seen a group of guys or a team that says this guy is the future, and he's streaking down the floor, and I'm going to look him off so I can dribble through cones. I've never seen any shit like this before, and like. This guy is everything that we need and everything that we want. We need to hitch our wagon to him. No. It's time for me to cook, right? Howard, I will never understand that, right? But Trae Jones, Vic, Devin Vassell, they have a pretty good net rating together. Like you said, you add another draft pick. I think Brian Wright, who's their GM, who's young, who's bright, really got a lot of foresight, really patient, really has a vision for them there. But of course, things have to line up. Players have to want to come to San Antonio. Or if not, you have to draft the right guys. You have to be in position to trade the right guys. You have to keep your powder dry in free agency while still kind of building a reasonably competitive team around Big Vic. But Howard, you said something about the 24-hour news cycle and us idiots talking about this stuff 24/7. Howard, he's going to be in his second year next year. That clock isn't going to start ticking for a long time. Any discussion about, Victor isn't happy. Hey, y'all, I don't know if you guys know how this works. There's 4 years on a rookie deal, and then there's a rookie extension that everybody takes. Why? Because nobody has never not taken the rookie extension.
It's designed that way. That's the point of it. Keep guys with their teams.
Even if you say Anthony Davis is the last guy who left the small market to go somewhere big, he was in New Orleans for 7 years, which doesn't sound like a long time. But when you consider it in the context of Big Vic, that means the Spurs would have 6 years to get this right from this point on. Yeah. But I'm with you. I don't think the conversation right now is warranted. It kind of sickens me a little bit. And I do think that if there's a franchise that warrants a little bit of trust, I do think it's the Spurs.
Yeah. And real quick, Wembanyama, point noted about guys looking him off in transition. And there's probably, like, they could be using him better. His teammates, the entire organization could be using him better. Wembanyama is tied with Steph for the sixth highest usage rate in the NBA this season at 31.6%. So, like, he's doing plenty. Like, he's doing a lot. His life could be easier, and he could be even more weaponized and more efficient and more devastating with a better supporting cast, and especially with like an elite level playmaker of some sort in his vicinity. And I'm with you too, Vinny. Like, yes, the reality of the NBA is guys, even if things aren't great, you're with your team that drafts you usually for the first 7 years. That's how, and that's half of a career, by the way. Like, most careers are 15 years or less, and the average career is way lower than that. But for a star of his caliber, 7 years is a big chunk of your career. He will probably be there at least that long, if not his entire career. They do have time. When I say there's pressure and urgency, it's a lot of it is just about the discussion and about the pressure that amps up. It's not that I think he would force his way out in year two or three. That's ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. It's more just that you know you got to get it right, and you have a responsibility and an obligation that when you have a player who looks like he could be one of the most talented we've ever seen, get it right soon, quickly. Like, make sure you're not putting an undue burden on him, and like, don't put yourself, your fans, and him in a position where you're even having to like explain away what you did or didn't do. Like, you want to start making the playoffs immediately. They don't have to be a contender immediately. You want to start making the playoffs soon.
And honestly, it's better for the NBA that we see more of Big Vic. That's just the bottom line of it. It's so much better that we see him in meaningful games and meaningful situations and marquee games, because we need to start transitioning to the next generation. Pretty much it. Right. Now, Howard, you brought up something a few minutes ago, and you brought up the 50-win marker of teams who are going to win 50 games. That's a championship marker. You said eight teams are on pace to do that. Three teams are in the Eastern Conference, a lot more are in the West, and there's going to be a few more knocking on the door, even teams that we're not even sure if that are that good. I say that to say, Howard, there was a point a couple of years ago where we felt like the balance of power shifted from the Western Conference to the Eastern Conference. The Western Conference had headed for almost two whole decades. And then it seemed like the Eastern Conference was getting its legs underneath them, and we were going to see at least like the scales being balanced. Now it seems clear, even if you go and just look at the play-in, the quality of the teams in the play-in in both conferences, there's a difference. There's a difference at the top and there's a difference at the bottom. Why is the East not good this year? Does it just come down to injuries, or is it just the West has drafted better, made more bold moves, because you don't see Oklahoma City and Minnesota coming like the way that they've been coming this year? Like, what is that? Because it seems like the Western Conference playoffs is going to be really compelling, and most people seem to think that the Boston Celtics are going to run through the East, and maybe they are, but I don't know how good they are or how great they are, even though whatever the numbers say.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, our discussion would be a little bit different if Embiid were healthy, right? Because even if we thought Boston... What's that? Yeah, because the Sixers would be among the teams on a 50-win pace at minimum. At minimum, we'd be saying there's four teams in the East, potentially five. Again, the Knicks are knocking on the door. They might make it. But we would have four teams for sure winning 50-plus in the East if Embiid had stayed healthy. That would help a little bit, but not to the extent that you're talking about, where it's like, okay, there's six 50-win teams in the West, likely. The play-in group in the West is better than the play-in group in the East. And the why and the how has always been weird. Like, there were a number of stories written in like the mid-2000s to early 2010s about like, all right, it's been like 20 freaking years. Like, why is this? And people have tried every which way to analyze this as to why the West is historically, or in modern times, consistently better. I don't know that there's any one reason. But it's interesting just to like even look at the teams that are at the top of the West right now. Like, all right, the Clippers pulled Paul George out of Oklahoma, but he was previously in Indiana for most of his career. That's the team that drafted him, right? So you have the typical like West or East to West shift there. Kawhi started in the West, goes, wins a championship in Toronto, but oh, no, Clippers got him. He's, you know, so the James Harden, again, started the West with the Sixers for a little bit. He's in the West again.
You forgot about the Brooklyn detour. Was in Brooklyn.
The Brooklyn detour, right. I conveniently forgot about. You know what's really weird about that? Because that was still during COVID and I didn't see any of those games in person, I'm not sure if I ever saw, I must have been at least one James Harden game in Brooklyn, in my backyard. That phase of the NBA is forever going to be kind of a blur to me. Also, just Harden was here for like 5 minutes. But a lot of talent, high-level talent, and some of these are older guys, right, have just drifted westward, right?
Kyrie and Kevin Durant were in Brooklyn, and now they are
now in the West.
Not so in the West.
All of that's part of it, but why we've got a consistent trend over like 30 years now? It's a combination of everything, right? It's, you know, ownership. It's who. It's GMs. It's draft. It's some of it may be weather too. Like, by the way, like the Clippers didn't used to be a destination at all. They were a freaking laughingstock. But now they're a place that it's like, oh, I'd really love to play in L.A. Well, I can't get to the Lakers. I'll go to the Clippers. Before, you'd be like, I can't get to the Lakers. No, we're not having that conversation. Send me to Memphis. Like, there was...
I've never heard those words before. Send me to Memphis.
But the Clippers are a destination now. And the Warriors, like my beloved Bay Area where I grew up, like the Warriors were never a destination. They were a terrible franchise for the longest time. And the weather in the Bay Area, not quite as nice as in L.A. I know how from having lived in both places for a long time. But these are places that are destinations that weren't for a long time. And I think that that's part of this, too, is like if you are whether you're an all-star or the tier right below that. Those are draws. Those are places you want to go. And they weren't. You know, not all of them were at times. So I don't know. It's a strange thing. It is a strange thing. And I'll be curious to see, like, as some of our stars age out, right? Like, how much more runway do Durant, Steph, and LeBron have? And they're all in the West right now. And what are those teams once those guys have retired? And is that the moment where maybe it does shift more East? Or does it not? Because Denver's still got a long runway and the Thunder have a really long runway and Minnesota's got a runway, you know, but the Clippers too. I should put the Clippers in that same conversation, right? Between all the Clippers stars, Suns, Lakers, Warriors, that's four teams where you can see like the end is near.
Yes. I mean, put it like this. And for all of those things, two quick points. For all of those things that we say about the quality of the teams, the West playing teams right now, Dallas, Phoenix, Lakers, Warriors. In the East, Pacers, Heat, Bulls, and Atlanta. The team that'll get the best chance to get to the finals is not a team in the West. It's the damned Miami Heat. Why? Because I've seen it. And also, they've had a lot of man games lost to injury this year. I think it's like some over like 200 man games lost. And I think Oklahoma City has the fewest man games lost to injury. They've been abnormally healthy, but young teams are usually healthy because, you know, they're younger. And secondarily, I thought about this because how you were on the beat covering the Lakers in 2001. And I think that was the last time, or maybe it was the most notable time. I think there were six teams that won 50 plus games in the Western Conference in the regular season. I feel like it was six teams. And maybe one team won 50 plus in the East. Maybe it was two. Maybe it was Milwaukee and Philly. And that was the year the Lakers decided, we're not going to lose a game in the playoffs. That's when they ran through 50-win Sacramento. They blew the doors off of Tim Duncan and the 60-plus win Spurs. Like, that Lakers team, what might have been the greatest single-season team I've ever seen in my freaking life, and that was a year where six teams won 50-plus games in the Western Conference. And I was a junior in high school.
You're just throwing that in there to make me feel old. Thanks, Vinny. I appreciate that. That was really gratuitous. And
Sorry about that. But now, as we have less than a month left before the end of the regular season, I think we got like 3 weeks, and it's like coming up quick. Howard, what team, you can give West, one East, or whatever, however you feel. What is the team that gives you the most cause for concern?
Concern about the status of that team and their prospects?
Yes.
So I'm going to throw in one quick caveat as a catch-all here. I'm always worried about the Lakers and Warriors, right? I don't know if they were ever truly in this, but at the start of the season, you want to believe, right? You want to believe that the Lakers and Warriors are going to be in this because we want to see LeBron and Steph be great and special and play meaningful games in the spring as long as possible.
Right.
If you're a fan of the game, forget what team you like. You just want to see the greats get to be great for as long as possible. But we're getting down to it, Vinny. Like neither the one of them has really been able to distinguish themselves or stay consistently good. So I'm not going to say I'm worried about the Lakers and Warriors because we probably should not have put them in the conversation to begin with. And who knows? They may surprise us. And I'll be perfectly happy to see that because I love watching those guys. So in the West, it's really the team I'm worried about is the Suns, right?
Yeah.
Like the Suns, I mean, there has never been more all in than Matt Ishbia taking over the team, immediately trading the entire future of his draft picks until like the next millennium to get Kevin Durant, and then going and clogging up the payroll with Bradley Beal and basically saying like, I don't care. We have no flexibility, no assets, no anything. We're picking up spare parts from the junkyard just to fill out the roster. And cool. Here we go. Let's see what we can do. Well, Vinny, last 15 games, and I hate doing these like little segments of the season sometimes because, you know, it's an ebb and flow to the season. It's a long season, right? It's 82 games. But as you get closer to the end, it starts to matter more. Last 15 games for the Suns, 8-7, meh. Offensive efficiency, ranked 14th, meh. Defensive efficiency, 20th. Net rating, 16th. At a plus 0.3 per 100 possessions. This does not profile at the moment like a team that's actually a contender based on the results, based on the numbers. They're 16-11 when their big three or their big 2.5, however you want to qualify it, play. That's a 48 win pace. That's respectable. They're 15-10 with the big three plus Grayson Allen. So, okay, fine. Like there's a bit of a proof of concept there, but it's also not a ton of games, which again, I think matters when it comes to chemistry and flow and comfort playing off each other and knowing exactly what you want to go to in a tight game. We talked about Denver, right? Suns versus Nuggets in a playoff series, tight game, 3 minutes to go. You may have more individual firepower and guys who can manufacture shots out of thin air on the Suns, but which team do you trust more in a tight game? 3 minutes to go, 2 minutes to go, couple point margin, you're going to say that's the Nuggets every time because of not just Jokic, but the track record those guys have and the feel for each other they have. The Suns don't have that. So I just, you know, and the other reason I worry about the Suns and they're top of the list here is because the consequences for them are really steep.
Yes.
Like, where do you, if you flame out, if you're out in the first round, now what? Where do you go from here?
Man, well, Phoenix was number one on my list, and I'm there with you. Like you've gotten as much as you possibly could have expected out of Grayson Allen, and out of Yusuf Nurkic, right? You don't really have a point guard. You're trying to do the Brad Beal, Devin Booker thing, which takes them away from the thing that they do best, which is playing off the ball and going downhill and getting to the basket or whatever it is. To me, it's more, I will say, macro. I look at this team and I'm trying to figure out what their identity is, like their signature. What are we good at? Not necessarily how do we look when we're healthy, but what is our organizational ethos? What is our ethos on the floor? Are we a tough playing team, or are we the smoothest flowing offensive machine in basketball? Or are we trying to be like, you know, Golden State 5 or 6 years ago where the ball's just spraying around the floor and we just get open shots for everybody? That ain't it. Because their number one thing to me is like, oh, when all else fails, Devin Booker or Kevin Durant is going to take a contested shot. And there's probably nobody that I trust more taking a contested shot than Kevin Durant. But Kevin Durant is 35 years old. Like, I don't know how much you can expect out of him. And not only is Kevin Durant 35 years old, you're also expecting him or hoping that he can play small ball five, which wears down the body, wears down the legs. And I think it shows up in the last 5 or 6 minutes of the game, and in the crunch, his crunch time stats are not good. You know
Dude,
what I mean?
Their whole crunch time as a team, or their fourth quarters, I think they're like historically awful in the fourth quarter. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know that Phoenix Radio, when I talked to them recently, was mentioning this.
It's not good. And you would think, oh, team with Kevin Durant and Bradley Beal and Devin Booker, but I don't think they found like a cohesive offensive system.
No.
That augments. And on top of that, even if you did, you don't have enough sweat equity on the floor to apply it. Where I know people, and Howard, this is one of those things. I'm not sure if you were a shorten the season down to 70 games or anything like that. I'm not. But 82 games, is a period for you to reveal some, not reveal habits. It's a chance to develop habits that will be revealed in the playoffs, to develop continuity that will be exposed in the playoffs. And if you don't have the sweat equity on the floor during the regular season for long stretches of time, in 15 games as a sample size, and 20 games as a sample size, whether you break it up in quadrants or whatever it is, you say 20 games, 20 games, 20 games, 20 games, whatever it is, like they don't have that 20 game, 2 month run where they're just like, okay, we're better than everybody out here. We've blown away the competition for a 2 month stretch where we're hitting everything. We know what we're going to do. We know what we're running offensively, defensively. They just look like a first round team to me. And that shouldn't be the case when you get Kevin Durant, who still looks like a reasonable version of himself, and Devin Booker, who's probably as good as Devin Booker is going to be. And they were my number one team. I'm going to ask you if your number two team, Howard Beck, is the Los Angeles Clippers.
If you could see the Word document that I have up on my screen, they are literally second. Although I put them after the Suns, but I also went east-west. So if I switch to the east, I could go Sixers here. But yeah, the Clippers are right below the Suns.
Now I'm going to bring Producer John in because Producer John can see my document. Now, Producer John, open your mic.
It's open.
Producer John, tell Howard what my two teams are in order on the document.
Oh, I got to scroll up. In order, the Phoenix Suns, the Los Angeles Clippers.
There you go.
It's the two obvious ones. And the Clippers are in a different spot because, Howard, I felt like they gave us the two-month run, right? They were atop the West, maybe for like a day and a half. And they were in that foursome of Oklahoma City, Minnesota, Denver themselves. Who's going to win the top seed? And unlike Minnesota, who's dealt with Karl Towns and Rudy Gobert going down and still maintained, the Clippers just have seemed to lost their way. And I don't know if that's a matter of age, and those guys, you know, and maybe the Russell Westbrook injury, which changes the pace. He helps on the glass. He helps you during those nights of malaise where your guys just don't have the legs and he can come in and play Tasmanian devil basketball. Maybe he's far more important than we ever would have gave him credit for. But I just have lots of questions about the Clippers that don't revolve around Kawhi Leonard per se. Paul George hasn't been inked to an extension yet, and we haven't talked about that at all.
Yeah. I know.
I got questions.
I got questions. We all got questions. God, the Clippers. This is. I mean, you talk about trust issues. This is why we all have trust issues with the Clippers, right? Like why we've had trust issues for years. Like, you're healthy. We're not sure, but we think you're pretty good. Oh, you're not healthy. Yeah, we don't trust you because you're never healthy. Like, there's always some little piece that is just slightly off. And this was the season where it's like, okay, Kawhi's healthy. Paul George is healthy. They both played. I think probably they're for Kawhi for sure the most he's ever played since he's been in LA, right? I think it's maybe the most he's played in like 8 years. They're always the if healthy, they're fine. And okay, they needed Ty Lue has been, you know, pining for a point guard forever, somebody who could really run it because yeah, Kawhi and Paul George could both do a lot with the ball in their hands, but it's like the Suns thing, right? Oh, how much better would they be if they had a true point guard there instead of Bradley Beal or with those big three? James Harden, as much as he's a volume scorer for a lot of his career, he is also an elite point guard and playmaker. And he fit for all the other qualms any of us, including me, might have about James Harden in the course of his career. The guy is incredibly talented, still playing at a high level, and understands that this is the place where he could reel it back and ride the other guys. And I don't worry about the Clippers. James Harden is you know, crappy playoff track record. I don't care about his crappy playoff track record because he's got Kawhi and Paul George. It's not on him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there's still something that feels like it's missing. And when we now have their last 9 games since Westbrook goes down, they're 4-5, 2 losses to the Bucks, a loss to Minnesota, New Orleans. These are good teams, but they also lost to the Hawks. Their net rating in that time is a -2 per 100. Minus net rating over a 9-game span since Westbrook went down. Paul Pierce was on, I think it was Fox the other day, Fox Sports, talking about they miss Westbrook's leadership. You're talking about the sixth man. If the sixth man is the guy who is generating your leadership and your verve and your, if he's the guy who's most critical, like, I don't know what that says about you, but it's really interesting. And it may be true.
Well, oftentimes your leader is not the guy who's your best player, but in NBA terms, it's the guy who's willing to fight. And Russell Westbrook, when he walks into a locker room, with the exception of one time, it seems like it's been his locker room. In Washington, it was his locker room. And Houston, I'm sure, probably was his locker room for the short period of time that he was there. And with the Clippers, I'm sure from the moment that he stepped in, it probably was his locker room. What's Kawhi going to do? Shrug his shoulders? You know what I mean?
Like, right, yeah.
I think the thing with the Clippers that gets me, you have three guys who play at a very deliberate pace. And PG, Kawhi, and James Harden. And it works, and it's almost built for playoff basketball, because playoff basketball slows things down. There's fewer fouls, the pace and everything else. But if you don't have a change of that, if you don't find a way to generate easier opportunities and you're relying on solely execution from your old guys, ooh, baby, you're asking them to play perfect. And I'm still a believer in Ty Lue as a coach. I'm still a believer in Kawhi Leonard with the remainder of his prime. And James Harden is in a much better position. But the West is so much better than we thought, or so much better than maybe the Phoenix Suns thought and the Clippers thought. They are in a world of trouble. Howard Beck, thank you so much, my man, for joining us. That is, in case you don't know, he's wearing a green The Ringer shirt. I'm sure Bill Simmons sent that because it's green, like Celtics green. So I'm sure you're probably repulsed by wearing that. Anything that you want to promote with us? Any book that you're working on? Anything special you're doing?
All kinds of things. I'm a special guy, Vinny. You know that. We've been friends a long time. Lots of stuff going on. But rather than giving away any of it, folks, just find my writings at theringer.com. You find me on Twitter at Howard Beck. If you're still on that hellscape of a site. Also on the Real Ones podcast every Monday with Logan Murdoch and Raja Bell at The Ringer. So thank you for giving me the plug.
That is the most Two Americas podcast you will ever come across. Howard Beck with Raja Bell and Logan Murdoch. Ladies and gentlemen.
I thought we were going to get through an entire show without you going hashtag Two Americas today.
Well, we did it before the show, but people just didn't hear it. That's all. But ladies and gentlemen, that is Howard Beck. Thanks to producer John and the entire team who works hard behind the scenes. Jake and Dan will be back for another episode of No Cap Room tomorrow. I will be back on Monday for another episode of The Good Word. Until then, everybody be safe.